application, because they do them. So we'll just say that that would be.
Actually, you're qualified, right?
Yeah.
Very close.
We'll schedule something.
The campus is.
Because that's part of the.
I haven't been here for a long time.
SCOs.
The campus is.
Recommendations, right?
The old Santa Fe Rail.
And we.
At Santa Fe and Third.
We.
So we're right.
We're current on everybody else.
The new project called One Santa Fe.
Yeah, but the three and.
Yeah.
Apartment building, but we're right up against the rail line and the river. I basically do with Third and Fourth Street. We've finished redoing that building, and we've got some vacant land, and I was thinking about next steps.
Well, I think I'll call the meeting to order. We still need one person, hopefully.
Yeah.
But.
He said he was coming, Michael Briggs, and so hopefully he'll be here.
That's fine.
Do the minutes at that time.
Okay. We have new board members, which is really growing. We're now, we're fully funded, right?
Yeah, we got all the positions filled now.
Fantastic. Could I start with you, and the three of you just kind of give us a little background of who you are?
Of course. So my name's Antonio Sanchez, the political director for IBEW Local 11, electricians. Grew up in the valley. Most of my family went to Mission College and then transferred out. Valley College and then transferred out. Now kind of live on the west side with my wife and 6-month-old. So excited to help them learn is what we need to do.
Welcome.
Thank you.
My name's Gary Cook. I've been in the construction trades for 42 years, working for contractors at mainly prime, a lot of work around the area. I'm a plumber by trade, and worked for the local union for 15 years. Retired.
Right.
We all strive to get there.
I'm Raymond Chang. I'd love to be here. I'm an architect by profession. I went to East LA College years ago, and I live in Cal Poly. I am also a licensed general contractor years ago. I've done architecture work and construction work for about 20 years, and then at 2000 at Twin Cedar Sinai, I've been overseeing their construction development in the last 17 years. I served on the East LA College Foundation Board. I was the chair for the foundation for about 17 years. I believe I served on the ECOC when we first have passed the property for a short time, for about maybe a year, or two. And then I turned down, and then I continued my work at the foundation. This time they asked me to come back, and I'd like to be back. And looking at some of the reports, I think that refined quite a bit from the old days.
We made a few steps forward.
Absolutely. It is very nicely put together, so.
Why don't we continue around the table? That way everybody gets introduced, everybody else.
So I'm Adriana Barrera, deputy chancellor, and I'm a regular at these meetings. But today I'm also representing the chancellor, who is at another meeting, and decided he couldn't clone himself. But my office, Lillian and Lori, my two assistants, staff the work for this committee. And so any problems with the material not getting to you on time, we try to email it as well as send packets by mail. And we ask for your best phone number, your best email address, and as long as Lillian is current, we'll get the communications to you. So anytime that there's any request for information or the like, if you'll contact Lillian, she's the primary contact, and she'll make sure that we have everything in order. We work closely with Tom Hall and Jim O'Reilly to make sure that we've got the materials to you in a timely manner. And primarily, you know, I depend on Lillian, so I'm going to let her talk about it first.
Well, she basically said what I was going to say, but thank you, Dr. Barrera. Yes, this is Lillian Mazariegos.
Frank Padilla, Facilities Planning and Development Department. I work under Tom Hall.
So, Tom Hall, I'm the Director of Facilities Planning and Development for the district. Jim O'Reilly is the executive, and I report directly to Jim. He'll be joining us in a little bit. But Frank also is the one that helps with the annual report. You know, when you guys put out that annual report, and we've done that with Dan for the last 3 years,
four years. Getting them out on time.
Yeah, getting them out on time. You know, it takes a little bit of effort because we have to get everybody together to approve the reports, you know, but Dan's been instrumental in making sure that we meet that requirement. So Dan will be rotating off in August, so we'll look for somebody to step up and help chair the committees after that. But Dan served with us for almost 6 years now. So I appreciate you guys coming on. You know, it's really nice to have people from the construction background coming into the meeting to understand some of the issues that we have on construction. You know, as opposed to, you know, we also have a mix of people from the campuses also that understand the campus life, and so this is a good combination because you understand both the educational world and the construction world, and so I think our committee is really set up nicely. It looks like Michael's coming through the door in just a minute here, and then Michael is our student representative, so we're going to go ahead and continue the introductions.
I'm Lisa Turnbuck. I'm the Deputy Program Manager. I just joined the program in February. So Tom Donovan, who you'll meet, will be here shortly. He's the Program Director. I also come from a 20-plus years of design and construction experience. I worked for a large bank managing their project management team for the Northeast, and I also sat on the Massachusetts School Board Authority for 8 years. So here to answer any of the questions you have about the reports and tell you about the program.
I'm Dan Minkoff. I've been with the bond program close to 8 years, and today is my last hurrah in the bond program. So I've been responsible for a lion's share of the presentations that go to this committee and the Board of Trustees and shared governance committees that help oversee the bond program during that time. So, but we transition that to the committee.
Hello, everyone. My name is Harold Lewis. I'm a student here at LA Trade Tech. I'm also the treasurer for the Interclub Council, which is the organization that looks after the welfare of all the clubs on campus. And I'm here actually by accident. I knew Michael from years ago, and he was looking for the room, so I helped him with directions. And I have some time before a meeting today at 3, so I'll sit here as a member of the public.
Welcome. Great. I'm Nick Yagaska. I've been with the program since ACOM came on board in 2013, supporting the various activities that we have in terms of communication on the program. I'm also overseeing the ACOM internship program. Proud to have some City College as well as East LA College students interning at our various campuses. Good to see all of it come together.
Great. My name is Dan Swartz. I am chairman for this meeting, next meeting, and the meeting after that. And then I am termed out. I've been on the board for six very exciting, turbulent years. I'm really pleased that we're getting more people with construction expertise. Under the state law, it's sort of bizarre that this has to be overseen by seniors and people representing all kinds of other groups who have no background in construction, and they get dumped in these meetings and hear all the trade talk and are supposed to absorb it. So I'm really pleased that people have background. I'm an architect. I went to the University of Michigan a million years ago. I'm now retired, but I sit on the board of a couple of organizations to keep myself busy. And welcome, everybody.
Hi, my name is Eric Bubbers. I've been on the committee now, I think, 2 years. I'm
This week, I'm celebrating my two-year anniversary of retirement from a 40-year career in biomedical research in Maine. So I know absolutely nothing about construction, which I guess qualifies me. And I also am a member of the Valley College Foundation, currently serving as the vice president for the Valley College Foundation Board.
But he also brings that perspective of the college life and what the faculty, you know, so it's that good mix that we need, you know. So, Tom, do you want to introduce yourself?
Apologize for being late. Tom Donovan, I'm the program director for LACCD. I'm with the AECOM. Glad to be here. We had an important meeting with DSA, so just ran a little
late. Did we win?
We did win, absolutely.
Michael? Hi, everybody. My name is Michael, and I'm the student representative. Thank you all for everything.
Michael is one of the ones who shows up for every meeting, which I think is really important since we always have a quorum issue. Okay, moving right along to our no public speakers. The approval of the minutes, did everybody get a chance to take a look at those? Are there any comments? Seeing none, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes as submitted. We have a motion, second?
Second.
Any objections? Approved unanimously. Okay. Do you want to switch the chancellor's report and the construction updates around until Jim gets here, or do you want to take those down?
We can have Dr. Burra, if she's ready, to do the chancellor's report.
Yeah. Let's move directly to the chancellor's report, and then we'll circle back.
Very good. So, if Chancellor Rodriguez were here, the first thing he would mention is the fact that the district has just launched what is called the LA College Promise Initiative. This is an effort that mirrors the national effort under President Obama, which is to make the first 2 years of higher education, in this case, community college, tuition free. And so about 67% of our students already have some kind of tuition waiver. But that leaves about, we think, about 7,000 students that would be coming in from LAUSD. So the initiative is actually a career pathways initiative from the LAUSD into LACCD and then onto a CSU campus. Partners include the City of Los Angeles. Mayor Garcetti actually unveiled the LA College Promise during his State of the City address. And it's gotten lots of press, and now we're really in the beginning stages of designing what that actually means. And what it means is that to begin with, it'll be launched in the fall of 2017. We will need to raise about $3.5 million from business and private entities primarily to cover the cost of at least what we think is an estimate of 7,000 students that coming to us from LAUSD that would not be eligible for some kind of financial aid. So of the students that would not be eligible, we would need that source of funding for the first year, and then thereafter it's a multiplier factor. So it is a very, very large initiative. There are some things happening in the legislature that might help us as well. But the plan calls for the first year experience to be one that is very, very structured at the community college so that we build a network of support first year, move them on to the second year, and then hopefully have them graduate within 2.5-3 years right now. Nationwide, we're not alone. Average time to completion at a community college is about 6 years because majority of our students are part-time students. This initiative would help our students by helping them enroll full-time. The success rate among students goes up exponentially if they're enrolled full-time. But what it also means is that if we are successful, that means our classrooms are going to be full and we're going to be moving on to the next stage. So right now, we have capacity at all of our colleges. We do have space available, and you know, we have classrooms and that are available. I mean, we do have space available in our classes, so we're not, you know, at 100% capacity. But with this kind of initiative, we anticipate that we're very quickly going to fill those classrooms. And so, you know, the work that you're doing here becomes extremely important as well.
How does this handle the students that we admit who really aren't prepared to enter at a freshman level and they need the remedial help? Is that covered by that, or is that?
It would be covered for those students that are taking basic skills classes that are still at the college level, college credit level. It would not apply to anybody that is enrolling in courses that we would say are non-credit, which is, you know, I think that would be something like maybe four levels below college level work. So we, you know, so there are a number of initiatives that go with this. The another initiative, for example, is a summer experience. So it's like a six-week boot camp. A lot of our colleges already have this in place. And it is exactly for that. Some compressed learning, compressed instruction will has been shown to really facilitate the learning process. So someone that is coming in at below grade level, below college level, can come in and do the summer experience and then into
that,
the first
but
year.
But that costs them money to do that.
Yep. Yeah, that is extra. But the good news is that we do have a number of our colleges do have that summer program already built into their operations because we've already seen the success that they can build into it. What we haven't done is the tuition-free first year. So just for a number of reasons, we think that that's going to be very exciting, and it's we're just in the. I was just reading a message that came in. We're just in the midst of developing a core team district-wide that is going to help us to design what that first year experience is, and then Chancellor will be putting more meat to the structure and going forward. And we think that one of the challenges will be that funding opportunities. And so as Mr. Chang, who has been a foundation board member, knows that it's a lot easier to sell when you say, I need $150,000 to equip this lab or for 20 scholarships or for, you know, so we're part of the first year experience will be also to design what elements of that first year experience we can fund externally. One of the things, so we introduced ourselves and went around, and one of the things that I was going to say as well, and I'll let Kevin introduce himself as we go on, but Kevin Jenner is our interim general counsel, and one of the things that general counsel does in terms of this group is provide an orientation for new new inductees, new members to the BCOC, so that will be in Kevin's shop. And so just kind of letting you know that that's something that's probably about a one-hour session, something like that.
Moved, Dr. Burke.
Actually, news to me.
So there is a So at any rate, we have in the past provided an orientation session for new committee members, and as we are coming to an end now of the semester, our graduations are scheduled for June. Most of them are on June 7th, which is a Tuesday. And see, in counting back, I think Trade Tech's graduation would be on the 4th. They are going to have their graduation in advance of everyone else. Beyond that, I think that we're just got the news. We're going to end our year with a nice, healthy ending balance. So we're in good shape budgetarily. And so now we're actually planning for next year's academic year. And as I said, all of next year was going to be focused on that fundraising and putting that first year experience, putting some detail in that first year experience so we can go forward.
And our student population is continuing to grow, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We have slowed down. We have a 3% growth at this particular time. We have slowed down, but outside of Los Angeles and probably San Diego, growth is zero among community colleges. So we actually are looking to capture more money as folks, as the other districts report their enrollment this summer, and we'll capture money from districts that didn't grow.
I know Dr. Brer touched on this as far as orientation for the new members. We will be getting a hold of you and try and schedule that with Kevin, because in the past, Camille Goulet was the one that set those up, and she's no longer at the district office. So we'll work with Kevin's schedule and your schedules and try and set something up. It may end up that we do it ahead of the next DCOC meeting,
right?
So you wouldn't have to make a special trip, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah, that's been the most convenient. It's like an hour ahead of a meeting, and then you just have the orientation, and you cover the Brown Act and the bylaws. This is a Brown Act group. We do notice it, and we do make provisions for public comment, and we do post the minutes, and we ensure that the board has approved all of the members, so we've gone through that process.
Very good.
Jim.
Dan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Long
You're
time
not the cast?
The day's still young.
Yeah.
if I rolled up my sleeve, though, you'd be impressed by a road rash from about here down to my ankle.
Jim is a not very successful motorcyclist.
and a cyclist in general. Anything with two wheels, I like to crash. So I'm usually in a cast or have some bandages around my head or something along the lines. By the way, I'm Jim O'Reilly. I'm the chief facilities executive. So I usually go through and give you a construction update. I try to keep it broad and general, and then we can get to some specifics later on in the report. Today I'll go through, and Dan likes to hear projects with challenges. He doesn't want to hear the good stuff, which I don't blame him. He wants to see where we're challenged and where those are. We'll go over that in a later report. It's called the PMO update, which these folks will give you. It's the program management update. The Office of Program Management, sorry, will give you the update. In there, I'll let them take the glory for any of the good projects today because we put the good news into that report. So I'm just going to tell you about all the bad things. Or not bad things, let me say. We'll go back to challenges.
Challenges, sorry. Yeah.
Opportunities for success. First of all, a big program update. We look at this from the aggregate and where we are. Total funding we started out with here was $6.27 billion. That was made up of three different bonds, J being the latest one that was passed in 2008. That's the one we're working off of primarily right now in the projects that are there. That was the biggest one, over $3 billion. We've contracted for $5.14 billion of the $6.27, which leaves us $1.2 billion remaining to be contracted. and we've expended 4.77 of that 5.14 that's contracted. We've completed 233 out of the 400 planned projects and 608 of the 825 sub-projects. We're almost there on those. Currently in construction, we have 31 projects ongoing with 36 sub-projects out of those. And in design right now, still to go, is 38 projects with 53 sub-projects. So those are a lot of data and a lot of numbers, but as you can see, we're most of the way there. And we're working off the last part of our work here. We had to, we were using a contract vehicle referred to as lease-lease-back for many of our selections. Lease-lease-back allows you to use best value contracting, if you will. So what we look for is we typically do a request for qualifications. We go through the qualifications. We will shortlist the best for the project, let's say to five. We'll then go to those five bidders who will come back and give us another proposal that will include a cost proposal in it. So when you have an RFP, a request for proposal, there's going to be a dollar value attached to it. That's the difference between the RFQ and the RFP. When we receive the RFPs, we then go through and interview each of the teams, and from there we'll determine who we select. Now, it's not always going to be the lowest bidder. I think we've only had one case of where we took not the lowest bidder, but often because there's a point total, and price is part of it, but it's not all of it. So we don't have to take the lowest bidder. So first of all, the qualifications get rid of any of the people who might have given us trouble in the past or bad actors somewhere else. And then when we get to the proposals, we do the same thing. It gets very, very competitive, and hopefully we have a good stable of those five contractors that we shortlisted. We can go ahead and pick from there, and they're all going to be wonderful, and they can all do the work.
Sorry, is this before design or after design?
It's typically after design. So
then they go to the contractor?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So yes, sir. So they'll have that's how they put together their proposal, their cost proposal, is utilizing the plans and specifications that we have. Now, that got tried, or it got, and John will help me out with this. Is John. He's the construction general counsel for us. So anytime we get into trouble, he gets us out. So I was just going to tell
you. Keep your way from
John, since you just walked in, I'll let you talk real quick about, just give them some history on what happened up in Fresno with the lease-lease back, what I just described to you.
Oh, okay. So the Davis versus Fresno Unified School District case was from the Court of Appeal up in the Fresno area, and it involved the 17406, which is a K-12 lease-leaseback statute, not 81335, which is our lease-leaseback statute for community college districts. And the case there basically said, you know, it's a lease-leaseback is a legitimate delivery method. It is an alternative to competitive bidding, but the court went ahead and made two broad pronouncements, one of which was, but you have to have a true lease and you have to have contractor financing. Neither of those two components is actually written into the statute. The court found it by going back and looking at the legislative history of the statute from its inception back in the 70s. And unfortunately, didn't go beyond just making those two broad pronouncements. It didn't say, well, what does a true lease really look like? What does it consist of? How long does it have to be? It didn't refine or clarify how much financing does the contractor have to come up with. Is it 10%, 50%, 100% of the cost of the project? Just doesn't say. So because of the two broad pronouncements, it gave rise to some uncertainty about just what do you need to legitimately use the statute. So at this point, we are not embarking on any new lease-leaseback projects. The ones that we have done in the past several years and which are still ongoing are all grandfathered in and protected under Civil Code Section 863, which is called a validation statute, which means if nobody's challenged them within 60 days of their starting, then they're not able to be challenged. They're legitimate contracts. So, but the board wanted to take a cautious footing moving forward. Really good delivery method. Sorry we can't be using it right now. But hopefully we'll get some clarification either from another court or maybe the legislature.
Just clarification to people who are new.
we didn't do that many deals leaseback in any case, because that was not our original way of procuring services. We have had three different ways of doing it, leaseback, but also the standard design build and design bid build, and a lot of our contracts are those latter two, mm-hmm. and those are still the way we are approaching ongoing projects.
Right. And on the larger projects, we would typically want to go with these leasebacks or some kind of best value scenario. And the ones we had done were quite successful, and we were going to continue using it until this case came along. But never fear, we've come up with some different ways. Many of these we've converted into design builds. So we would bring in the contractor and they would bring in their architect. We would have the architect that was working on the drawings become the program architect, and then bring in a slash design architect and a general contractor's design build entity to use. We didn't convert all of them. We weren't able to convert them because of where they were. In some of them, we are at the Trade Tech Culinary Arts comes to mind. It's one of the biggest jobs they'll have here. We had to go out for re-procurement after we had already selected somebody under the leaseback, which is unfortunate. Many of the other ones we converted. There's also to the Technology Learning Center at West that ran into that. That's got to be re-procured. And that's scheduled to be re-procured any other time. Some other important things to note, and I was going to hit, this one's going to be in my challenge projects, is the VAC Center at Pinner. It's a large performing arts center. Originally had four theaters in it. It was a Stephen Ehrlich design. Very nice building. We recently got in bids in, or we got our bids in initially in January, and they came in approximately $15 million over where we wanted to be, from like, let's say, 67 to
83.
Yeah. We were around there, so quite high. We went back and did a value engineering exercise with them for the last several months, three to four months. They've been working on it, trying to get the price down for us, looking for other opportunities with different subs, some other things. And we've come back in at, currently we're at 79 million. So that still leaves us 12 million over. But when you go back and start to break it down from the estimate, you'll start to see where it comes out. Yeah, we've had a little bit in the escalation category, maybe a couple points, a few points in there. But there was also, the original estimate did not pick up many of the finishes. And in the equipment packages, we were going to go out and get those from another purveyor. We've decided to wrap those back into this particular contract. So when you get down to it, it doesn't look as bad as it sounds. That doesn't mean that we're happy about it, because we're going to have to take this and sell this to the board to get it to go through. The project originally came up a couple years ago, and I was initially opposed to it because I thought that there was just too much money dedicated to the theaters, and when you really needed some classrooms and some other things there. The college accepted that, and in fact the board supported me in that, and went back and asked them to convert one of the theaters, which they really had four theaters in it, one of the theaters into some classroom space or some more lecture space. They made those changes and did what the board asked them to do. But we still have to take it to the board to get approval to award this contract. And that one's still up in the air. So that's why there's a challenge attached to it. We know of at least one board member who's somewhat vehemently opposed to it. He was not happy with it initially, and we'll likely put up a fuss about it. But we'll see what the other board members have to say.
Does this impact other projects you can get done now in the college? So
it does impact other projects, since they had to go and find some money. They had to go find another $12 million.
Which is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. They went and found it from some other projects that were going to get built. And the college took it upon themselves to find the money to actually move forward with it.
Was the program in the beginning, the architect team underestimate what they were designing?
Yeah, I think it was a blown estimate.
Stephen's an awfully high design guy, and as you creep up that ladder, you tend to have more cost surprises.
It's a very sophisticated facility, a lot of architectural features, a lot of materials that are not common, some of the glass, some of the architectural finishes on the outside of the building, some of them are manufactured in only certain places, so.
Yeah, no doubt, I'm sure.
Not in this country.
They want to build the best money can buy, but if they were given a budget in the beginning, they should work, try to work hard within that budget.
Yes.
I agree.
I think in the past, and I don't want to rehash history, but in the past, the colleges had a lot of leeway with the design. If they wanted something, they would add on to it. And this might have been a case working with Stephen Ehrlich. He's high design, does a lot of really beautiful work, but it's not cheap. And what he designs is, you know, high priced materials. And I think they probably had a user group about this size, maybe larger, working with him. And I think it was one of those instances where they loved what they saw, but so they bought what they saw. They wanted it more and more, and figured they would go and get the money. At that time, there was a plethora of money, not so much
anymore. One of the realizations that we come to as a project team over the last 6 years is that there is actually a finite amount of money, and that there isn't this building downtown called the central office where you can always just somehow pull the money out of it. And we now have a situation where each one of the colleges has a fixed budget. That's all they get. And they have had to organize their master plans and prioritize everything so that they're absolutely sure that they can finish everything they start. So we don't spend money on design, then just shows up and goes nowhere. And we're at the point now, we're close enough to the end, that we've really pretty much identified the projects that are going to get built with these funds. There's a contingency that, well, most, like all contingencies, eventually get spent, but it is not allocated now. And there are a whole bunch of projects at every campus that aren't going to get done. And people have finally come to the grips with that.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. Yes, sir.
This is at Valley College?
This is at Valley College, yes. Yes, sir.
Being new to the board, but knowing a little bit of the history, and it seems you're here to talk about some of the problem trials, can you briefly tell us about the project across the street, this campus?
The parking structure?
Yes.
It's going to get done in August.
Okay.
Now, the history on that one was We had a design build for a parking structure, a substation, and a very large construction technologies building, which I was very excited to build. It was going to be about a $90 million project. We had contracted for it with a design build entity comprised of Bernard Brothers and HMC Architects. They had a very difficult time getting it through, getting approval. I think it was 11 months late, thereabouts. And John, if I'm wrong, facts. And the only reason I'm asking the attorney in the room is because he had to get involved in just a moment. I'll tell you how that went. We received DSA approval finally from the entity. And I think it was the next day, pretty darn close. The discussion came up about the $10 million delay that they had incurred and how we were going to be on the hook for it. I had no intention of paying Bernard's $10 million, and it was undeserved. I told him to go get lost, and I wanted to recompete the project at that point in time. We were also getting a new president here and thought that ultimately he should be involved in the decision. We discussed it, and he wanted to move forward with Bernard's, but not the Construction Technologies building, and to actually use that money somewhere else on campus. That money is going into the Trade Tech Culinary Arts building, for example, and some other projects. So the construction building is not being built at this time, but the parking structure is.
And the substation.
And the substation. And the parking structure is very important to this campus because they have to pay for excess parking and anything else that goes down here. So it's a big project for them, and they're looking forward to it, and it'll actually save them money in the end.
The extended overhead, that issue has gone away?
Yes, what we did was we got involved and negotiated what we call, it was called a cleanup change order, so that they put all their ducks on the table, and we parsed them pretty severely. There were funds that were owed to them for the extra services for design that Jim mentioned, the delay in the design. They really didn't have any extended overhead in terms of general conditions, because they weren't mobilized on the actual site, but they did have a lot of additional design time and so on and so forth. So that $6.9 million claim ended up getting resolved with about $500,000 in additional monies on top of actual out-of-pocket money. So it went away for just slightly south or north of $2 million. But that also cleaned up all the disputes between all the parties, including the 40-some-odd subcontractors who they had brought on and were in the process of utilizing their services, more or less from a design standpoint. They had been released to do some certain groundwork, so there was a little bit of that had gone on, but basically we drew a line in the sand, everybody waived all their claims, we established a new budget to finish the substation and the parking structure and moved forward and avoided a very costly piece of litigation.
Excellent. And then the building that's been canceled, there's no part that cleaned up with Bernard also.
Correct. What you may notice over there is I think it is getting paved to be used as a parking lot in the interim. And then on the north end, we relocated the storage facility, some kind of storage facility.
Right.
So that was all wrapped in together, all part of the deal. And then obviously that area still remains for some future construction of the construction technology building.
Excellent. Thank you.
So some of the lessons learned on this one. Was it Bernard's problem? Was it HMC's problem? Was it something that we could have done better? Or?
Yeah, I think
it was a multitude.
Yeah.
There was a multitude. Nobody owned the problem completely. Everybody shared in some complicity for where it was, when it was, and what had happened. There were issues with the drawings. There were issues with some of the management. There were issues with the district campus making decision changes. And so it all impacted it. But we think it was a very good result, and I'm sure we saved $500,000 in legal fees if this had to get litigated.
Okay. All the decisions about what gets built, what's prioritized, they're done at the campus level, and they have less flexibility than they used to. They used to have a tremendous amount of
full flexibility.
And we went through a period of time when we had almost no permanent college presidents. It was kind of a continuing in and out. So sometimes the priorities of what people wanted to get built on campus changed, and that's made some things very difficult.
And a lot of that changed about 4 years ago. The board passed a resolution that kind of re-centralized some of the authority. And it's still, we try to take the vision of the colleges and help them achieve those and get the things built that they want to. But we stand as another group who can say, you don't have the money for it, or this might not be the wisest idea or the best use of your money. Let's look at maybe here or doing this, or should we modernize this building? And we try to help them facilitate their educational master plan, what they have in their head. And that's part of our job. And as Dan mentioned, we have a lot of turnover in the president. So oftentimes, or what we've seen in the past, I should say, not oftentimes anymore, they would come in and make some changes on their own, which might throw off decisions that were made in the past. So we had some expenditures out that way, but that ceased to happen.
What happens if there want changes now?
If they're bright changes and the right thing to do, then we do them. If they cost additional funds or might not be looking for the, we have to make sure that people aren't looking for the short term, we're looking in the long term. And if they benefit us in the long term, then we'd go ahead and change it. If not, we'd probably stick in a different way.
Yeah. Most of the projects now have
pretty much we're committed to.
Yeah.
And so if someone would decide now that they didn't want this project, they wanted another project.
Fix the board.
If we've already spent money on design, that's a problem because we're walking away from that. So we're getting to the point now where you can kind of visualize where we're going to be, even though it's 2018 is our last,
that's right,
I guess, active year. But you can pretty much get an idea of what we're going to be built out as when this is done.
That's correct.
As Mr. Schwartz mentions, each college has a set schedule now of projects to be built, and the budgets have been vetted both at the college level and at the program management office level. And if they want to deviate in any significant way off of those approved lists, which were all put to the board, they have to bring it back to the board for a major change. They don't have the authority to make
it. We're starting to spend money on design, major money on design on projects that are due to be completed in a couple of years, so it gets expensive at this point.
Yep.
Right. As the program manager, and Lisa and I are going into some of the details, we're both fairly new to the program. I've been here for about 4 months. Lisa's been here for a couple months. But over the last 4 months, we have worked very, very hard, done deep dives at every single one of these campuses on every single one of their projects, and to make sure there is enough money. Dan's statement about, you know, we're sort of at the top of a hill here. We only have $1.2 billion left. You know, we have contingency, we have risk associated with each one of these projects. They're all identified. In some cases, like VAC, they have made a decision, but the decisions are where they are now. We're very, very resistant to any change at all in direction because, again, we only have so much money left, and we want to get built what everybody wants to get built and has identified. And so we're watching very, very closely every month, every dime we spend. So working with Jim and his staff.
In the other, I mentioned a couple of challenge projects, one being the theater out at, or we call it the VAC building, out at Valley, and also talked about, well, I talked about the parking structure, which isn't challenged anymore. But the third one I want to talk about is the theater here, the Trade Tech Theater. I'm going to let Tom speak a little bit about it because it brings into concern the DSA. We have a theater here, which I think very, in a very liberal sense, is historic. It's been here a while anyways, but I don't think it has any designation at all. It really needs to come down. We built a building next to it that is dependent upon the demolition of that theater, or a reconstruction if you really wanted to do it, to get certification from the DSA. Tom, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so, and I kind of mentioned this, a few of you were asking the question earlier when we first started, but the theater itself was never part of the original plan for the DSA and the improvements, and we did receive some state money to match on this, on the remodel of the building. Used to be called the A building. I'm not sure what the name of it is now. But anyhow, we did receive state funds on that, on part of the building, and it shared a common wall with the old theater. Well, the problem is in order to get the DSA sign off, we have to do something with the theater, you know, and right now it's kind of sitting there in limbo, but we are pushing the college into making the decision on what we do with that theater. A lot of that will depend on where they see that theater in the future. I think it'll probably end up coming down. We haven't made that decision from a campus perspective, but one of the things that might possibly play into it, and I don't know if you mentioned this or not, is the board is exploring the idea of a new bond. And as they explore that idea of a new bond, we've been asking the campuses for the submittals of projects so that we can start talking about that. So that may have an effect on that building. I'm not sure at this point. But in order to DSA sign off, we either have to tear the building down or rebuild the building, one or the other. And and we have to have DSA sign off as part of our state requirement for the state funding. And so it's one of those projects that we're going to have to keep an eye on.
Is there, I don't know, community pushback or someone saying save this theater?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, not yet from the outside. Some people have an emotional attachment on campus for it, but we haven't heard from any preservation societies, and I hope we don't.
Have we looked into why it might be, aside from the fact it's an old building? Is there an important architect, or was there,
No, in fact, who designed this thing?
A.C. Martin?
And Chris Martin looked at it, his grandfather designed it. And Chris Martin looked at the drawings, and with our president said, "This is not my grandfather's best work. Tear it down." So that was, that was his response to it. So
you won't get, this is off the record, Linda Dishman to fire up for it.
That's who I don't want to deal with. I had to deal with her on the Ambassador Hotel.
I've been dealing with her my whole life.
And even if we, and I think we should build a new theater. If we built a new theater, we could save some of the. There are some really beautiful features in the current one now, and we would want to save some of that. The ceiling comes to mind.
But we do need to get all of these state architect approvals as we approach the end of this, and we've made a tremendous amount of progress on getting caught up on some of these outstanding for years, as I understand.
We're getting pats on the back from that today.
22 left.
Actually, that's where I'm
meeting with DSA today.
The state architect himself was in town, so that's where we'd flown in from was a meeting with the state architect. He's not always in the LA office, so it was good to have a meeting with him. He gave us a pat on the back with respect to closing out those uncertified projects and what kind of job we've done on the things that here and what we've inherited. So he's very happy with our progress with respect to that. Now getting the certifications has come up, and they had said to us today that they're going to do everything in their power to help us, and gave us two or three different ways in which we could receive certifications, not through the normal channel. So it was really, really good and very productive.
Yeah, so as long as you're willing to work with us. But the part that puzzles me is that you said we got a building that we couldn't get signed off because it has a common wall with the theater, and they said, you're not going to get it until you make a decision on that. Was it a structural reason, or what was the reason behind it? And how did we get the permit in the beginning?
Yeah, well, the permit allows for the remodel of that building. When we got into the building, the common wall in between there, they said you need to address that. And that's
structurally.
Structurally,
can that be?
Yeah, seismically.
Can we build a steel frame on the inside of the other side?
It could.
It's actually connected, isn't it, Tom?
Yes.
The common wall.
You reinforce that wall, should be something acceptable to them. I don't understand why would they hold you hostage.
Because it's attached to this theater, which is old and crumbly. Mm-hmm. And even if and it was it one project number or is it two project numbers?
It's one project number.
Okay, so this is. Here's the new building in this terrible marker.
Okay.
New building. So this is the common wall.
By the way, you're not writing at all. I hope you figure that out.
Yeah, you know what? I'll get this up. But this is how I think sometimes. I got to draw a picture to think out loud.
Okay.
This common wall, since it's all one project, this theater was supposed to be done at the same time this was supposed to be done. It was money issue with this one, right?
They never really developed the plans to remodel that one at this point.
Really, really expensive.
Right.
And to do it. But they did build this building. Now we can't get this one certified because this one's attached to it, and it's all under one project number. So they considered it one project, and we haven't built half of the project.
So the solution is partly
lesson learned. I am no time.
Some sort of structural.
It's legitimate. I mean, it's
single projects.
What they would want us to do for us to get it closed out is to make it safe, which is basically what you said. Go back and do all the structural retrofits.
Well, can you at least reinforce that common wall?
The common wall.
We have done some reinforcement of the common wall, but we still need them to, we still have to address that building itself.
The easiest way to do it is tear it down. The easiest and the cheapest way is to take it down. Because it also needs a tremendous amount of site work done around that, that's going to be part of that project as well.
Because that building's attached, you have to bring all the fire safety stuff up to code and everything, and, you know, that hasn't been
and
done.
And these are the decisions that this board doesn't make.
I wish it did. Then I could blame you guys for all my bad decisions.
Without plan and money, you had half, and now you got stuck with half of the building.
Well, and we had that problem a long time ago in our program where things were happening that way, and then we centralized a lot of the functions and have addressed a lot of those issues. We actually, on a project like this, we would have asked before they ever started, you know, how do you plan on addressing this? But when we started out the program, it was centralized and then it got to a decentralized nature. And, you know, so a lot of these decisions like this were made at the campus level, and then now we've centralized it back, you know, so, but the one thing that we've told the college is you have to address this issue. You know, you can't run out of bond money and not have addressed this issue. So if there's a new bond, you know, and we are exploring that idea right now, if there's a new bond and there's new funds, you know, that would probably be on the ballot in November.
This is kind of where the bond committee does get involved. We really can't hope that there's going to be a new bond issue that eventually takes care of this problem at
right.
some time. If this is a certification problem, we either have to have a plan to deal with it as is, or hold back enough money to rehab the theater, which people may or may not want. But we certainly can't get to the end of this bond thing, have this project hanging out there uncertifiable and no money.
Right, and we are holding back money right now for to address that issue. You know, we haven't spent it yet because, you know, the decision may change in 5-6 months if there is additional funds.
So what was the magnitude of money holding back to admit these things to the federal?
Rory, you
want
to?
Thank you, Tom. I'm Rory Lorenzo. I'm the college project director here at Trade for the Build program.
He's also going to take you on the tour in a little bit.
Yeah.
So.
Have some maps up here for everybody. But on your handout here, your strategic plan, the Grand Theater demolition is priority 6, which is our last priority here on campus. We did earmark money for the demolition, keeping that the symbol wall and the demolition of the remainder of the theater building. However, we did offset that to the end of our construction program, but it is earmarked for the demolition, the dollars are set aside in the strategic plan.
So that may be the ultimate solution, is tear the thing down because there's no other solution.
That's right. Correct. In what Tom was referring to, we have some projects floating out there right now where we don't want to do something silly right now if we're going to have this large influx. And we're not planning around it, Dan, but the things that we don't have to plan around are the things that we can don't have to take priority and be done within the 6 months. We are doing a little bit of wait and see on that. But I understand what you're saying. Don't plan around it.
I'm just sitting in meetings where I hear Garcetti wants a tax for homelessness around $2 million. This city schools want to go back for another bond issue. I forget, somebody wants a partial tax to increase. There may be 4 or 5 major bond issues coming up on City of LA voters, and that usually spells nothing gets passed, which is interesting.
Yes, sir.
And roughly, so I have an idea, not to get into any detail, but the money that you set aside, is that enough to structurally demo, I should say, enough to demo the theater now and just build a wall there, or to build a new theater?
It's to demo it, not to rebuild a new theater. Just to give you an idea, and I'm going to throw out some wild numbers. It would say that, you know, $35 million for a new theater versus $8 million for the demo, but that includes also all the site work connecting around it to complete the campus and complete that part of it.
Okay.
That's a common wall, so if you demo that wall, you have to rebuild another wall for the new building?
I don't think so. Do you know, Rory?
We won't demo that wall.
Yeah.
And actually, Tom was correct when he stated we did do some seismic structural repair and upgrade on that wall already. With the the building's called Magnolia Wall that's around it, which is the building A. So once we do the demo, we will separate it from the rest of the building, leave the common wall up with the seismic and structural upgrades that it already had, reinforce the wall on the outside so it has a better exterior view once we leave it there and remove the rest of the building.
Okay. Yes?
Mr. Chair, my name is Harold Lewis. I'm a student here at Trade Tech. Is it known whether or not there are any environmental concerns if it's decided to demo the theater?
I can't answer that. Do you?
So we aren't to that point yet in a decision-making process. So we'd have to do a little more exploration to see if there's any issues in tearing that building down. But we feel like we've held enough money for that contingency in case we do run across some issues. So right now, I would say, you know, we're a little premature in deciding, you know, whether or not, you know, what we're going to do with that building. You know, we really haven't made that decision. You know, in 6 months, we'll probably have a clear idea as to which way we're going to go with that building.
And just to furthermore on that, to answer your question with regards to the environmental, anytime we go into an old structure, go into demo structure, especially from a certain time period to a certain time period, they have used some hazardous materials in certain cases. We'll go in and do surveys in which we'll bring in environmental firms that go in and do not only regular testing and site testing, they'll do destructive testing to look at the floors to see if there's asbestos tile or to see if there's asbestos in the mastics.
That's what
the glues or in the insulation. So they go through this testing to determine what the need would be for that. Okay, thank you. With that, we've got some what I think are pretty good news. That's one of the reasons John is here, our attorney, just to give you a bit of background. He's been here, what, 2 years now, John?
Two and a half years.
So prior to that, when the general counsel had run all of the legal services out of their department and had a stable of attorneys. Well, what we did about 2.5 years ago is we brought in a construction litigator, which is John, somebody who's especially astute at construction issues, and he now runs the stable, if you will, of outside firms when we need them. What that's allowed us to do, though, is John's been able to solve a lot of the issues right away out of his shop and do them as opposed to farming them out at a pretty extraordinary cost. 2.5 years ago, we were running very, very high in the legal fees, and we've been able to close out a lot of cases and to save a lot of money in the meantime. But John will tell you all about that. John?
Okay, thank you. Can I ask a quick question? When it says legal fees, are these fees actually paid to lawyers, or is it legal fees plus settlement costs?
The settlement costs are not in these numbers.
Okay, so this
any settlement money is received by the district or paid out by the district is okay, not so part of this. It's just legal costs.
Okay.
Legal costs. It does include the cost of consultants, claims consultants, and other experts that might be utilized as part of.
It doesn't or does?
It does.
It does. Okay.
And for those matters that are in litigation, it would also include court filing fees. It would include deposition costs and so on and so forth. So if I could ask you to turn to page 6, just to give you an overview in the legal fee and expenditure report. And just for some really quick background, the first time I ever did anything with the district was in about 2010 with the prior chancellor, Daniel LaVista, who put together an independent blue ribbon review panel. And I had never worked for the district before, and the district's program was getting a lot of bad press in the LA Times. And so that chancellor put together this blue ribbon panel of about 9 individuals, including assistant vice chancellor for all community colleges in the state, the city engineer for LA, the deputy CEO for county of LA, We had labor represented at the table. We had vice chancellors of construction from UCLA, Caltech. It was a pretty interesting group of people, and I had the honor of chairing that panel. We spent about a year, it was all pro bono, and we came up with a 40 or 41 page report, which I think is still on the district's website, and about 17 recommendations to the Board of Trustees for changes to be implemented in the bond program, which they subsequently have done. They've implemented them. They were also working on their own improvements, and so as a result of all those efforts, the program and how it was structured began to take a turn, and one of the big things that Jim mentioned earlier was that centralization of control back at the district level, as opposed to out, you know, 9 separate colleges all kind of out there doing their own thing.
So, John, sorry. Also, the accreditation, the state during its accreditation process also verified that all those recommendations were followed up. So the accreditation process
So fast forward, I think I delivered that report in January of 2012, and sometime early 2013, the district went out on a request for proposals for this position called Lead Construction Counsel, which is what I now hold. And basically my charge is to handle all legal oversight of bond program matters with the exception of workers' comp matters. And so we still have 14 or 15 law firms on what we call our outside counsel bench. We use them as needed, but one of the things we've done, and if you look at page 6, you can see where I physically became involved around July of 2013. AECOM had been brought on a little earlier that year, and a little earlier in that year, there was the decision to move the direct control for handling the bond program legal matters to the facilities division, and Jim and Tom. So we basically, the three of us, worked very diligently through the back end of 2013 trying to identify what we saw as the risk indicators and the problems in terms of how legal and claims were being handled and so on and so forth. And so we finished our assessment by about the end of 2013. You could see that for the prior 3 or 4 years, the legal fees were just, in the program were just escalating, just running directly almost on a vertical line upwards. And so we began implementing new measures, new procedures, new protocols, which are all laid out, and at least in a summary fashion in this report. And as a result of that, by the end of the following year, we were able to kind of stem the tide and the rise by about 400,000. And then by the end of 2014, we actually had implemented a whole new bevy of additional changes. We ended up rewriting all the construction contracts, all the policies, practices, procedures. We rewrote all the vendor contracts, our architect agreements, engineering agreements, our laboratory of record agreements, our inspector of record agreements. We implemented a lot of new processes in terms of the change order, how we approach change orders in the program. We built into all of our contracts, construction and construction related, a new expedited claims procedure, and so on and so forth. And so what you see last year is the result of all those very heavy collective efforts that took about a year and a half to implement, and we dropped the legal fees and costs in the program by almost $4 million, down to about $3.9 million. And on the road that we are now moving on, those fees will be less than this number in 2016. By the time we finish the year out. If you could turn to pages 10 and 11, I'm just going to continue to give you the highlights at this point, but on 10 and 11 you can see some of the things we were faced with as a group when we did take over, and what they and how they stand now. So for instance, on page 10, we've had over 75 procurements, and one of the things we did in August of 2014 was we rewrote the protest procedure, because almost every procurement was getting protested. We've now had over 75 protests, and we had one protest filed that was abandoned. So that has just saved an enormous amount of time and money and effort. We had 65 pending.
John, 75 procurements.
Procurements, did I miss?
Yeah, you said protest.
Oh, sorry. 75 procurements and only one protest, yeah. The protests have basically dried up. The procurements are still going forward. We had 65 pending cases, including stop notice matters. We're now down to 4. We had 8 pending arbitrations, we're down to 3. We had 19 formal claims, we're down to 0. And on page 11, it has additional information such that as of this time, we actually have no formal claim pending against the bond program. We have some litigations that are long-term historical and we're working through those, but we really have brought the process to a place that is very, very manageable. And obviously, even though we were dropping fees by $4 million, that included cleaning all this stuff up. Since the facilities took over in 2012, there have been, I think it's on page 10 at the bottom, it's just summarized. We were, the program was facing approximately $90 million in claimed damages, and because of the settlements and everything else, we were able to negotiate resolutions approximately at 33 cents on the dollar. But we also recovered almost $12 million during that same period of time for the district. It's become a pretty kind of no-nonsense approach. We try to involve ourselves early if we see a problem arising on a job site and get it resolved right then and there so it doesn't fester and it doesn't boil up into a formal claim or an arbitration or a litigation. And other than a couple of stop notice lawsuits filed that we now get rid of very routinely and very much more cost effectively. We haven't had any kind of major civil action filed on this bond program since 2012. So, yes, sir.
The fees and costs, so you don't use bond money for that, right? How is that?
We do use bond money for that. Bond. Yes, okay. But that is bond eligible money.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Can you tell me a little bit about the one with FTR?
That is a long-standing, one of what we call our legacy matters.
The contractor that just keeps giving.
Yeah, and so anyway, that lawsuit arose out of a debarment proceeding that took place within the district of that contractor. The contractor felt that he had been wronged and his civil rights were violated, and he filed a lawsuit, which is still ongoing. It's gone up to the Court of Appeal once or twice. It's come back down. We just had notification that our trial judge, who wasn't so nice to us in the beginning, has been reassigned. So we have a new judge.
How did we do that?
And that's a good thing. It's being handled by one of our outside panel counsel firms, although Kelly Colville, who's the risk and dispute manager of the PMO, and I oversee them. And obviously we report to Tom and to Jim. And that, unfortunately, continues to be ongoing. And there have been efforts to try to resolve it, both from a settlement aspect and motion work. Hasn't been successful so far, but it just continues to hang around.
Pardon? Didn't FTR go into bankruptcy?
No, he didn't. He was flirting with it. But if he had, then the case would have been stayed and maybe a creditor could pursue it. Now, he's facing $40 million in judgments.
Didn't we have like 8 sureties projects?
I don't know the exact number, but there were quite a few.
Significant.
Now, his surety took over and finished whatever projects were outstanding at the time, and because of their general indemnity agreement with FTR, which every contractor has to sign with a surety company. When he stopped performing, and I don't know, maybe he did file, I'm not that familiar with the underlying issues in terms of his BK, but they took over, and under that agreement, they settled with us, all of the matters that they couldn't settle this one because it was a civil rights case. But all of the projects that he's kind of relying on in the civil rights case to claim damages against us for, quote, allegedly violating the civil rights, all those underlying projects have been compromised and released by his surety to us.
So the outside panel firm, and I believe that his ability to prove damages in the case that he has pending against us are probably extremely unlikely. But we just can't get the case ended so far. But that's the FTR story. That's what.
Their reputation far precedes.
Yes. Yes. Well, I was one of the primary outside lawyers for LA Unified's bond program and actually helped them set that up and wrote all their contracts and procedures. And I litigated personally against FTR and the Zark Cappy at least 8 to 10 times.
Hasn't some of our legal situation gotten better because we just have a better stable of contractors that we're dealing with now in the last couple of years?
I think that's true from my perspective, from what I've seen since I've been here.
That was the idea the whole time. There was when I arrived here, there was a lot of FTR-like, doing a lot of design, bid, build, litigate type of contracts. And when we went to a more of a negotiated sum, we attracted, I used to be the director of new construction at Los Angeles Unified. So it was a similar situation when we came in. We ran into the bad reputation thing, and we were able to get the Clarks and the McCarthys and some of those folks back involved in this particular program, or more involved in this program, looking at more and more work. And when you have those contractors with those kind of horses and that kind of ability, it really makes your job a lot easier, and it really makes your litigation go down because they just don't want to litigate. It's too hurtful to their reputation to be a bad general.
One quick question on the recovery. The money we got back are stuff that we find them to the constructor, the construction team made a mistake on the error and omission, that kind of thing? Or
usually they've caused delay to the project, or we've had to spend additional monies on architects and CM fees and things of that nature. Or maybe they didn't finish some work and we had to hire somebody to finish it. So, and those monies come back to us and then get reallocated back to, if it's legal expenses, they get allocated back to the legal, the central legal reserve. And sometimes some of that money goes back to the campuses as well for other projects.
So moving forward, we are holding them to the contract and going after them whatever damage it costs us.
Right. And one of the things that wasn't done a lot was, in my personal opinion, and I've shared this with the board, is that we haven't held our architects and our engineers and some of our other vendors as closely as we should to their contracts. And we've ended up paying through the nose to contractors for not doing so.
So we have not gone back to that,
Oh, absolutely. Every time we have to make out a payment to somebody, we assess who might be able to reimburse us for it.
Oh, okay.
Yes. We're not a bank.
Do you have anything else, John?
No, that's it for my report, unless anybody has any questions. Within the inside of this, there is a summary of all the different processes and procedures we've instituted. There's a much heavier management and reporting structure that's been placed on the outside panel council. And we monitor that monthly, both at the PMO level and at my level. We make them project how much they're going to spend next month. And we watch them very closely and make them explain why they need to spend it and what they hope to achieve by spending it. Thank you.
Thank you. Great job. Thank you.
Any comments, questions of any nature? We have any old business?
I've got, are we out of time, Dan?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. I wanted to have the program management team present their annual update to you.
Oh.
And it contains a lot of what we're up to and what we've been doing and where we're going.
Let's go for it.
How we've done it. Okay.
Go ahead. Just maybe I can make one comment that adds to John's perspective on process. Change orders for the program have been much more controlled because of all the process changes and having a better class of contractors associated with the work. You just shared the Blue Ribbon report, and there were some statistics in the high teens of change orders under the old program, and we're down around 6.7% for the program since AECOM and John's group came in. So we're working really hard, and that's another result of more comprehensive approach to this platform. So I'm going to turn it over to Lisa. She's going to talk about sort of where we are.
Good question. Change orders from the time that they're up. What's the timeline?
Target is 60 days
from
when it's submitted to make a decision about whether it's valid or invalid, and have it processed.
And they can all be tracked online, so.
Right. And that's our target. I mean, we have some variation of that, but we measure ourselves and have KPIs for change orders that we produce and evaluate at each of the campuses.
It also varies by delivery method as well. Whether you're doing a design build project or a design bid build project, it would have some differences. And I'm not sure exactly on the start and stop date on the 60 days, but just to mention that most of these things get dealt with in advance. We have also implemented a lot of constructability reviews and other reviews on the drawings that we're getting. And then with pre-construction services contracts with the contractors, we're getting their input on the drawings so that hopefully you can avoid change order situations. Now, you're never going to avoid them completely, but we've hoped to minimize that. The other tool that we've given the people in the field, the college project team members out there at the actual campuses who are the management arm on site, is something called a construction directive or field order. So that if something comes up that is obvious as a change and it needs to be done quickly, then with Jim's approval, we can issue the construction directive or the field order and get the contractor started on the work so it doesn't delay the project. So that's
I guess that's what I was going to ask. So during that 60-day negotiation, the contractor, they have to continue the project.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. That's part of their contract. And if there's a dispute, it might end up in a claim.
One of the new tools that we've also put in the contracts is what we call the partial agreement change order, which is something that I had initiated at LA Unified back in 2000 or 2001. And it's simply this. Contractor says, I have a change and it's worth $150,000. We agree it's a change, but we only believe it's worth $100,000. And we just can't come to a meeting of the minds on that extra $50,000. Well, under the old model, which is standard in the industry, not much happens. The contractor gets told to go do the work. Nobody pays them anything. That festers, that accumulates, and by the end of the job, you got a whopping number of these things and big claims to deal with. So under the partial agreement change order process, in that scenario, a change order would be written for $100,000 and processed immediately, because that's the extent of the party's agreement, the partial agreement. And then the contractor has the absolute obligation to take that $50,000 into an expedited claims process immediately. And if they don't, they forfeit the $50,000. So the dispute ends. And then the expedited claims process is designed to resolve in like 45 days. Keeping it more at the business level, decision making to try to resolve, only going to a mediation or an arbitration if needed.
Great, that's good. Great process.
Okay, so I'm gonna focus on this annual update report that you have, and I just wanna clarify that we do this major update twice a year. This is through December of this year, so it's a little bit behind of where we are today, but the report goes through a bunch of different topics. It starts out with cost and schedule information and then goes through topics like DSA approvals and other things that I'll walk you through, and feel free to ask questions as we go. But I'm going to stay at a pretty high level given the time that we have left. So as you can see on page 2, we have the $6.2 billion bond funding, and we've spent to date approximately $4.7 billion, or as Jim said, through March, a little bit more than that, and that's about 75% plus of the money that we have funded. You'll note in the very last column F, that there is a surplus of $130 million. That's roughly the contingency that we have at this point, and don't want to get anybody's hopes up. We haven't committed that funds yet, but we still have, we'll see later on our risk assessment that some of that stuff, we do have placeholders for it. If you, focusing on the largest ticket on that summary is the college, as opposed to the satellite central services and the district initiatives, those are more program-wide initiatives. So focusing on the college, if you go on to slide 3, you can see the split by college and where we stand according to our funding. $4.75 billion of funding for that, and we've expended $3.9 million of that, approximately 80% of that. You'll note that there's a shortfall of $11 million. That is an accounting adjustment. If you were to go back to the dashboard today, that's gone. So still on target to spend what we have for funding. Slide 4 is a really important slide. It goes back to that $130 million contingency. And so on the right-hand tower, you see the add-up of all the contingency funds that we have available within this $6 billion. The left-hand tower sums our potential exposure to that. And overall, if you look at the difference between those two columns, you see approximately $100 million worth of contingency that we would have left out of that $6.26 billion. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and to think, we don't have $6.6 billion left, right? Obviously, we have $1 billion, right, round numbers left, so that's 10% in round numbers. But the reality is, you know, through each of the projects, we have assigned contingency at the project level, and we've assigned a risk to a risk matrix for every project at the project at the campus level. So there's contingency in the projects, but there's also $100 million right now above that campus level available.
I have a question on the right-hand tower. I think I understand the program, so that's the number we've always kind of talked about. What are these other three pockets of money? Where are they?
So just as Tom said, so starting from going
bottom.
Yeah.
The $100 million is what's baked into, essentially, if you go back to slide 2, it's what's baked into the colleges. So you don't see that there. So that's kind of
the project.
That's at the project. So the $100 million is at the project level. The $27 million is at college level. So within each college, not only is there a project, but there is what we call it an owner's reserve. So at the college level, there's a contingency. Then if you go back to slide 2, there is the district bond contingency that's across the whole board, whole program, and then the program reserve as well. So we've got many belts and suspenders.
Okay. Right, and I think this 14 was quite some time ago.
Yeah,
and that's when it was discovered it's not enough.
And the 130,
so they took back.
The independent
panel took back.
We had a satellite college money, right, that we took back, and a few, yes, other budget, yes, items that we closed out to create the 133.
Yes.
Okay. Now we're going to try.
So then, and just to explain it quickly, it's on the first tower. There are potential commitments from the legal side that's in the dark blue. There are change orders that are out there from the projects.
Haven't been processed yet.
And then we run a risk model twice a year. So the green and the purple bars are, and the 40J one that's very tiny, those are the potential risks. So if everything was to go sideways, those could be things that we'll pay. But the likelihood of paying all of that out is slim. We'll pay some of it out, I'm sure, but not all of it.
So the left is conjecture and the right is real money?
Yes. Okay. Going on to slide 5, it's a summary of what we have going on in each phase of a project life cycle. So going back to what Jim said earlier, we do have 31 projects in construction currently, and we project to have approximately 40 going into construction before year end. Moving on to
I have a question. So on the pending, so Southwest has 0 and Pierce has 7. Is that just because Pierce got started later, they have a project?
That's exactly what happened. Pierce went back and remaster planned, if you will, at a later date, and kind of decided to wait it out until the market settled down a little bit, and they consciously did that.
And we're out of room in Southwest, so we have one project essentially, Soms, that we just awarded to Harper that I mentioned, and that's pretty much the last project.
We've got, besides that one, we've got
a couple small things going on, but that's the major element that's left.
We've got one piece of land that's even buildable. There's a tremendous amount of faults that run through that particular campus, so we're building on one of the last pads. There's one left.
Slide 6 talks a little bit more about the procurement awards that are coming up, and I just want to call attention to what you see going on in July. You see a significant increase in construction awards, so this is going to, by the end of the summer, we should be ramping up on some of our construction dollars at certain campuses. Slide 7 is an overall remaining work by college, both construction and total project value, and you can see Pierce is one of the ones, as you pointed out, Antonio, that puts a little bit behind the curve and has a lot more construction remaining, along with Valley and Trade Tech. Slide 8 just goes further on just some of the project activity.
Lisa, I'm just, should this be 2016 new contract awards, or is, okay.
Slide 9 is really a good story that I think you guys heard us early on refer to this. On the far right-hand part of the page, you see that we've significantly decreased the amount of outstanding closed without certification. And we've gone even further to bring that down closer to 20 in this first quarter of this year. So that's something that we're, you know, partnering with DSA to close some of those issues out.
So what was the concern on not issuing the certification on most of these projects early?
It varies.
Some of them just got old.
Yeah, some of them had other projects attached to them that weren't finished. Okay, and that.
We did a lot of bundling of projects,
yes.
And so you had to finish one project and then another project, another project, in order to get the sign up for the whole
lesson learned.
We now bundle in a different way.
Yes.
We bundle for procuring, but not for control. They all have separate contracts.
Okay.
I have a general question as well, too, and I'm on page 5, just on the total projects by campus. I got it, this is online, but I got it, some everything was funded by me. But where can I find that? Where can I read about that as far as the projects and how it was assessed, who needed what?
The strategic plans, I believe, is
right.
Where you would.
That's where you would find it.
Okay. Have you taken a look at the Build LACCD website?
I have briefly.
It's a lot of information.
A lot of
it is amazing.
Everything you best find, you can find.
Website I've ever seen. And you can go back in there and just, you know, click on a college, click on a building, get all kinds of history about the building. Amazing.
But if you're asking for how were the what decisions were made in terms of what are the remaining projects by campus, it would be in those strategic
execution
plans.
And that was something we've been pushing, we meaning the board have been pushing campuses to do over the last 18 months. Get you only got one more shot at it. Decide what it is you're going to build and what you're going to pass on. And I think we're pretty much have that done.
Yes. I think we are. Aren't we?
Yeah.
Are we done across the board?
Yes.
Moving on, slide 10 is safety is very important to the program, and just, you know, our reportable incidences are very low, and we do keep track of it and make it very visible to the program to make sure that we're not having any reportables or incidents. I forget who brought it up, but if you go on slide 11, the change order, you'll see that we have these are our KPIs that we have that we manage the team to. While you might see a lot of Christmas tree lights over on the change orders, there are some legacy issues that we're trying to close out, but we do manage
those,
the team.
Those don't get exempted from the process, so most of where you see red, that's the challenge. It's not exempted. existing project, we're doing okay, but we haven't cleaned up some of the legacy issues on the campuses.
Another thing that's important to the program is the local small and emerging disabled veterans companies. We've done a great job of reaching out to the community and getting those people involved into the program. So out of 297 companies represented on the program, about 60% of those are local suppliers. And the task orders are roughly the same, 60% have been awarded to these local small and emerging companies. We go even further to take a look at on slide 13, to look at the contractors to ensure that they're engaging their local workers and hiring. And as you can see from this, we put the goal out there for our contractors to be at 30%, and we are achieving that.
And we have a new labor agreement that raises that to 35.
Did we just finalize our draft insurance policy?
OSIP? Yes.
That just got done?
It just got done, yeah.
Moving on to slide 14, I think Enrique mentioned early on that he was involved in the internship program that we have going on with AECOM and our partners, and we are bringing these students into our college teams to work on some of our program, and I believe Rory even has some out here at Trade Tech. It's very important to this program to get these students involved in our build program.
Right, and one of the things we do as AECOM is we also have students in our other business lines locally here, transportation, environmental, our water business. I think we have 7 or 8 additional outside of the campus that are outside of this program that are on our EECOM. So it's important to us.
Slide 15, as you can well imagine, some of these smaller contractors may need some help ramping up to our stringent requirements on how we manage the program. So we do have a program that reaches out to these contractors to put them through a boot camp on how to do work with us. And this shows that we have great participation by these companies who want to get involved in our program. We try to help them as much as possible. We give, on slide 16, we do some pre-qualification workshops. We teach them to bring them along for our program so that we can have good performance and active participation from those smaller companies who may not have the resources internally to do that.
On page 14, so the internship program, why is there such a difference among the AECOM partners?
Because I think AECOM compared to some of these partners is much larger. We're able to do a lot more.
Right. And if I may, so some of that is through this grant, the H-1B grant. AECOM has decided to go above and beyond that and hire these students into our separate business lines.
So we're funding it not through the grant, but through AECOM. Yeah. 13 right now, not being funded by the grant.
And who gets on Harper for not doing anything to us? How does that happen?
Well, we have a group of people that
they can qualify, right? They can qualify for the grant, H-1B grant. We could have contractors, we could have subcontractors. We could place these people and get actually grant funding anywhere in the program. So they could work for a contractor, they could work for a consultant. It was a pretty significant sum of money. I think it was around $270,000, but it had a time frame associated with it, so we had to try to put as many as we could where we could and Harper participate.
Okay, slide 17 talks about our PV buyouts. The most important one is the one at ELAC, and I won't go into the details on the following page because we just asked the board to buy out the system there for a not to exceed price of the $2.9 million, so we're on target to do that by the June 1st date. Actually, it says May 1st here, but I believe it's June 1st.
Yeah, it's roof. mostly solar parking, solar panels on parking structures.
At this point, say that every campus has.
Yes.
And some are leases, the rest of them are leases. This happened to be a power purchase agreement, and just the terms of the power purchase agreement were unfavorable to the district, so that's the reason.
So who's the SE or what power? Who is buying back the power?
So we have three campuses that are SE, and then we got six campuses that are DWP, yeah. And then we have one satellite's DWP that we have. Solar on most of the campuses, the degree varies depending on the campus. Like Harvard's got almost 2 megawatts. And then like this college has a little bit, but not much. You know, so depends on the space where we can put it.
So all generated power goes into the grid anyway. And then they just pay you back based on what you generated, right? It's like a credit.
Right.
We don't you consume the power we generate.
We consume most of the power we generate, except for like Harbor, and then we're putting back onto the grid some power.
Okay. So we take ours out first to the extent right. we need it.
Yeah.
And if excess. We have excess, we sell it back to the power company, and then if we need it, we buy from the power company. Both entities that we deal with, it's all retail pricing.
As far as what we get back,
and what
we don't get back what at the level that you would expect. You know, if you were buying the electricity, you're getting a lower level back. Yeah,
all right.
They're only going to pay you so much for it, and then they resell the electricity basically.
Oh, I thought they had to buy it at retail and sell it.
No, it's at a lower price. Yeah.
So it's safe to say that Harbor has the most.
Harbor has the most, yes. And if you go down there, you can see almost all their parking lots have solar on. And so they've got.
And across the board, we've been getting very good production out of every single one of these arrays, actually a little bit above what the expectation is.
Okay. Anything more we're running?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a tour that I think
yeah.
is what
yeah.
very valuable.
We are adjourned for the tour, and something we started a couple of years ago because we thought it would be important for everybody on the board to see what it is. Actually don't want to leave it again. So you are the tour director?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I have some maps here and guides. Yeah. Once I take the tour,
I still have email cards.
Yeah, upstairs. Right.
Are we coming back to this room?
We're in this room. We are adjourned now. I think you can leave stuff here if you want, but most people don't come back. Most people tend to drift off to their island.
So this is one crowd, nobody didn't.